Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello there and a very warm welcome to today's broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick and I'll be with you for the next half hour. In a few moments. Did the children of the ancient Romans go to school? Opening up the Vatican's secret archives. Towards a pastoral approach to culture. Well, thanks for joining me once again. There's a new culture in the world we live in, a world which no longer has any frontiers and depends to a great extent on the influence of the media. An all-new complex situation which originates not just from whatever content is eventually expressed, but from the very fact that there exist new ways of communicating, the most startling of which is no doubt the internet. Those are just a few lines I extrapolated at random from a document published by the Pontifical Council for Culture on the eve of the third millennium, at the time of the pontificate of the late John Paul II, a document by the telling title of Towards a Pastoral Approach to Culture, which enhances the urgency of the mammoth task of the Catholic Church in the fulfilment of its mission in proclaiming the gospel in the contemporary world. And one from which I'd like to highlight the first lines. Quote, from the time the gospel was first preached, the church has known the process of encounter and engagement with cultures. For it is one of the properties of the human person to be able to achieve true and full humanity only by means of culture. Unquote. One of the people to have participated in the working of this document was Monsignor Peter Fleetwood. He told me how the late Pope had requested this document, insisting perhaps on this theme, partly because of his all-time fascination with the relation between the dominant cultures of the world and the faith of the people who live within and are nurtured in those cultures. My first question to Monsignor Peter was how to get the Christian message inherent in this document across. Who to ask?
No, I think maybe the best people to ask about the difficulty of the accessibility of the Christian message to culture are mothers and fathers who have children that they try to bring up in Christian terms, Christian morality, Christian doctrine, a Christian view of love and life and death and the afterlife. And they're the best people to tell you exactly what the difference between Christianity and the dominant culture is, because the young people of any age absorb the culture much more quickly and much more thoroughly than the old people who have a certain resistance to change. And so I think anyone who has brought children up will know the distance there is. And pastors try to be compassionate and aware of this universal difficulty. The accessibility of the Christian faith to its surrounding cultures is a real fundamental duty. Jesus himself didn't expect everyone to tune into his way of thinking. It was rather the other way around. He was ingenious at picking up on people's hopes and fears. And that was the very title of the major document in the Second Vatican Council that prompted all this excursion into the modern and the postmodern world. Gaudium et Spes, the hopes and the joys, the sorrows and the anguish of people today are the things that the Church is equally involved in and wants to be involved in, because the message is for humanity. And if we can't speak to humanity in the way humanity thinks and acts, we're wasting our time and losing a valuable treasure forever.
We wasting our time and losing a valuable treasure forever. With a brief brushstroke in words, Monsignor Peter painted a picture of the passing of time for me, reminding me instantly of the insistence in this document of the word new, new cultural situations, new areas of evangelization, meaning contemporary forms of understanding and sensitivity.
I think the word new is spoken by people who treasure the past, but wonder how perennial or lasting or everlasting values can be put into new situations and made to mean something. How we can communicate between old and new, between eternal and temporal. The whole exercise is one of communication between, almost between different worlds, certainly between different worldviews. And new to many is automatically good. New to others is suspect and a little bit frightening. Whatever that case may be in the, for particular individuals, I think it really is a question of communicating what you view as precious in a different situation from the one either you were brought up in or it was first preached in, if you like.
Different people with different ways of evaluating situations. That's all very well, I thought. So, I asked, in your view, Monsignor Peter, I mean for you as a pastor, are there more challenges or more opportunities in today's checkered world?
It depends what side of the bed I get up out of. It's like having a half full or a half empty glass. Very much it depends on the energy with which one approaches the question of the gospel. I think people who have genuine faith always see the obscure side, but there is an underlying joy which makes them want to say, this is worth listening to, this is good news, it really is. So there is a challenge in communicating what you have deep in your heart, even to your best friend. But it also can seem very difficult one day and yet incredibly hopeful another. I think it depends entirely on the circumstances and the energy of the person trying to communicate.
An honest answer, one that prompted a far bolder question regarding the more negatively worded passages in the document relating to our contemporary world, such as, quote, atheism, blatant religious indifference, all-embracing hedonistic materialism are marginalising the faith, unquote. Not mincing their words here, I said to Monsignor Peter.
Yes, my own opinion is that it's not always helpful to talk about lots of isms. It seems sometimes as though the people representing the gospel and the church to the modern world are a bit like the King Canute in ancient British history, who thought he could stop the tide coming in and eventually was soaked. I don't think it's wise to approach life in that way. However, many of the terms in this document have come from bishops around the world, and those phrases do come up with astonishing regularity in reports from different countries, different bishops' conferences. And I think they're a shorthand for a whole set of phenomena where the gospel isn't obviously welcome anymore. We are not immune to our culture. We live in an atmosphere which finds it very, very hard to take all this Christianity stuff completely seriously.
I noticed the document had plenty of guidelines to offer on a practical level, sort of like a response to particular needs, perhaps.
It's meant to be a pastoral document. It's meant to respond to pastoral needs. So the second section identifies the different fields of culture, which is a help to some people in some countries where the word culture is used in a very different way from the way it's used in other countries. So the fields of action or possible action and the fields of challenges are identified in section two. Section three is a response to that. How do we cope with all these challenges? What is the best way to get into the swim and do something about it?
There's some pretty surprising areas, aren't there? Religious tourism and I don't know, internet, for example?
Internet is probably the biggest new influence on every culture in the world, although you have to remember that more than 50% of people in the world have no access to telephones, so we'll never see an email message or surf the net. But as regards the bulk of humanity and being influenced, internet is one of the major influences these days. It has tremendously good potential, but already has demonstrated that it can be pretty evil. It's not evil in itself, it depends on how it's used. So here is a challenge. What do we do to make the most of it? The church should be right there as part of the phenomenon, really, using this brand new way of communicating to get its own message across and to be present in a different way.
Religious tourism.
Religious tourism is a great preoccupation in certain countries which have a great heritage architecturally or in terms of their native religion. Very often Christian archaeology gives rise to the possibility of marvellous trips, but many governments in the international organisations are now realising that religion is a good thing in terms also of bringing them business, bringing visitors. So to make the most of this and not to allow it to be purely good fun, but to learn something, to appreciate the origin of the artefacts and the buildings and the traditions, there's another challenge, there's another way the church can make use of something that's happening around it and not let it, another opportunity pass it by.
There could be all kind of responses to culture in today's world. So I asked Monsignor Peter, what's special about this particular document?
I think what you have here is a genuine attempt to say, let's do the best we can, and let's do it in an organised way, and let's do it together with some kind of shared idea behind the whole thing.
You've been listening there to Monsignor Peter Fleetwood, Towards a Pastoral Approach to Culture, was released back in May 1999. Meanwhile, it's time to join our next guest in this broadcast. He's Professor Alberto Meloni, an Italian historian and author interested in all things Vatican. Susie Hodges asked him for a comment on the opening of the Vatican's archives this week, an event which now allows historians access to documents relating to the pontificate of the founder of our radio station, Pope Pius XI, whose pontificate was sadly marked by the events leading up to the Second World War. Susie asked Professor Meloni then to shed light on this mass of historical documents, some 30,000 files making up millions of pages. Stay tuned.
For the historians, it's not a surprising act, and it's a way that confirms that the Vatican Archives is everything but a secret place with mysteries or things like that. From the specific point of view, the opening of the pontificate of Pius XI is, on the contrary, a great change in the field of historical studies, because it will let us know the attitude of the Catholic Church toward fascism and the beginning of Nazism, that is everything but well known.
And do you think it's likely, in fact, to shed new light on the Church's views on the growth of these ideologies?
Yes, I think that the people who think that from these documents we may find the Church guilty or innocent in front of totalism will be disappointed. We will discover how complex the Roman Catholic Church is, and how complicated are the relation with this great phenomenon that are the totalitarian systems in the middle of the 20th century. So we will see mostly the reason of the attitude that is already well known in the public arena of the Roman Catholic Church in the 20s and in the 30s, and we will have a better perception of the option that has been at disposal of the Roman Catholic Church, the intellectual, political and spiritual option available.
Now, as you mentioned, there have been accusations from some quarters that Pius XI did not do enough to speak out against the growth of Nazism. So you don't think that the release of these documents is going to in any way, shall we say, either put pay definitively to this controversy or just leave various questions still unanswered?
The question about if the Pope has done enough or not is usually the wrong question. Of course, the attitude of the Holy Father is a part of the attitude of the Roman Catholic Church. But in general, and mostly from the point of view of the 20s and the 30s, the problem is the attitude of the Church, of the Catholic in general, and how the Pope has been the expression of this attitude or has been a pastor tried to correct and change this attitude. And from this point of view, the next opening, the opening of the archives pertaining to Pius the 12th, will be important to make a comparison between the two pontificates who had, as it's usual, as it's normal, a different attitude in front of Nazism, a different experience of Germany and the Nazism ideology. So I don't think that the problem is to discover if the Pope is innocent or guilty. This is something that is interesting only in a polemic perspective. The problem, historically speaking, is to understand how much the Church reacted through its bishop, its clerics, its faithful to this. Everybody now knows a letter from Edith Stein to Pius XI asking him to break his silence toward the attitude of Germany and Nazism. And it was just a little note, and probably we'll find much more on this point. But I repeat, there is much more. The pontificate of Pius XI is the moment of the starting of the ecumenical movement as an official and public movement at the attitude of the Church. It was also a very important moment from a doctrinal point of view, mostly the encyclical Castricum Ubi in 1931, about marriage and contraception is something that has marked in the long term the Catholic attitude on this type of issue. And all of this may be better known through a direct knowledge of the documents.
Talking about these documents, I mean, what exactly is going to be released in these archives? I mean, I know there's going to be encyclicals and decrees and diplomatic correspondence. Can you give us a few more details?
Yes, the archives kept in the secret archive comes from the different congregation of the Roman Curia and from the apartment of the Holy Father. So the documents are arranged in series related to the different branch of the Roman offices and departments. So there is the document of the Secretary of State that is in this moment already a very crucial institution in the Roman Catholic Church. There is the work of the other congregation except the Holy Office, and the private documentation of Pius XI.
There have been some reports in the press that the material in these archives could include an encyclical called Humani Generis Unitas, which was never made public as Pius XI died before releasing it. Do you think this is going to be included?
Yes, definitely. We already know the text of this encyclical, that is a proposal of an encyclical that Pius XI accepted and asked to some American theologians in 1938, a doctrinal stop against the racial discrimination and the racial politics of fascism in Italy and Nazism in German-occupied territories. And not only the text that has been already published some years ago from two French scholars, but we will also find the reaction, the opinion, and those who advised to take a moment for reflection, to wait a bit, or those who were convinced that the time was proper to issue this type of encyclical. As I said before, from the archives, we have not, thanks God, to expect materials very important for journalism, but we will definitely find materials that are very important for history. And in the long term, the Church is much more feeded by a good knowledge of its past, much more than by the fight between advocates and accusators of the Church.
And how much interest do you anticipate by scholars then in these archives? Do you think there'll be queues of historians waiting to look at them?
Yes, I think so. Usually, there is much more people that is working on a subject where the documents are few, because this is less tiring. I hope that in this case, a great cooperation of historians may be possible. This is a very personal view, of course. I think that sooner or later, we have to behave like the American libraries for the president. So to create around a pontificate, a group of scholars who will commit themselves to the analysis and the publication of the documents concerning a pontificate, so to avoid the fact that things remain in this legend about good popes and bad popes. That is very normal, but usually not so coherent and so proper and unjust.
Finally, why does it take so long to release these archives? They're only being released, you know, at set intervals, in batches. Why is there such a delay? Because this is, of course, what some people ask.
There is no delay. The legend about the archives, that is more or less a Crypto da Vinci legend, is that there is some secret to be kept or some document to be destroyed or something like that. It's exactly the contrary. The delay is due to the need to offer a proper organization of documents, simply to put numbers on each of them, to create catalogs and so on. And this is the reason it takes time for opening of the archives.
You've been listening to Professor Alberto Meloni, an Italian historian and author interested in all things Vatican. Speaking there to Susie Hodges. But it's time now for our weekly rendezvous with our popular Latin lover. He's Carmelite Father Reginald Foster, and I begin today by asking him what kind of music his best friend Cicero would have enjoyed. And I'm back again with Father Reginald Foster, who I discovered has a good friend called Cicero. Is that right, Father?
Oh, yes. Well,
is he your best friend, your best Latin friend?
Well, yeah, the best friend of most Latinists, you know. Mm-hmm.
I also know that you like music. I just wanted to ask you a question. What kind of music do you think Cicero would have liked? The Beatles, perhaps?
I don't know. The Romans were very conservative. And perhaps not the Beatles. Some semi-classical thing he would have liked.
Who's your favorite composer? Do you think Cicero would have liked
him? I like Haydn. Haydn is my favorite. Yeah, I think he would have liked that. Mm-hmm. Not too wild. He wasn't that wild. He was funny. Yeah, the sense of humor, but he wasn't wild like.
Well, composers brings us to our first Latin word.
Componere, to put together.
Together what?
Putting anything, put together a speech, put together a work, all the notes together, the rhythms together and the themes together. So a composer is still putting things together.
But choir comes from Latin, doesn't it?
Choral, that's Greek also.
In a canticle?
A canticle, that's Latin.
Schola cantorum.
Association of singers. Schola is Greek, but anyway, yeah. Like a sect, like a small group is a schola. We think of schola as school, but that's really not the original meaning.
What about primary school? Primary is Latin?
Primarius, that's Latin, yes. Mm-hmm,
mm-hmm. And the master who teaches?
Magister.
Magister.
That's Latin.
Which brings us into magisterium.
Yes, the teaching of the church. Yes, yes.
Mm-hmm. So magisterium is a far cry from materialistic.
And that's material. Material is, that's Greek.
They're all Greek words. So
yeah.
What are the bookish words that are Latin?
It really depends. It's funny. The Romans got a lot from the Greeks, obviously. But most of the roots actually go beyond Greek, like to Sanskrit. Some of the words are just basic human syllables.
In Cicero's time, did the kids go to school?
No. They had private tutors at home. And it wasn't until way, way, way down the line in the 90s AD that the Emperor Vespasian hired the first public school teacher, who was a Quintilian. And Vespasian paid him, and he started a public school of rhetoric in the Roman Forum. But before that time, you were apprentices with an orator or a lawyer, or you had tutors at home.
So no schools for the Romans?
As we understand schools today, you know, 50 children or something in a classroom with a teacher.
So they were illiterate, the Romans?
Well, no, they were quite literate. It was just the system was different. That every family, for example, they had Greek tutors. Cicero had a famous Dionysius who taught his son and his nephew Greek. They hired these people and had them in the house.
But you're not going to tell me that literate is a word of Greek origin, no?
Well, litera, well, almost. A letter, you know, letter of the alphabet, and then you have literature and everything else.
So,
litera.
The Romans are rather poor in this field, aren't they?
Well, didn't Shakespeare say Greeks have a word for it? No? And the fact is, the vocabulary in Greek is much richer than Latin. And the other problem, of course, with Latin is that the same word can mean so many different things, you see.
Like what, for example?
Ratio can be reason, can be motive, can be a theory, can be a system, can be just about anything you want. They had fewer words, but they gave them more meaning.
So then,
or via, for example, via can be a road out there with the traffic, or it can be a method, and can, as you say, like a way of doing something is a via.
But communicare is definitely Latin.
Yeah, that's all right.
Communicate. It's the big word today, isn't it?
Yeah, to have something in common.
So who was the communicator in the days of the Romans? The scribe?
I mean, what do you mean?
How did they communicate? They wrote.
They wrote, yes. They wrote a lot. You'd be surprised. We have about 900 letters of Cicero. I mean, that's, you know, 2,000 years ago. So, and we lost half of them.
So they had a greater sense of the use of words.
Oh, yes, and the writing, and something we're not doing today, huh? With all this mechanical stuff. Of course, we want to call email writing, which is... But they wrote very much more. We have sometimes we have letters that he would write two or three letters to his friend, Atticus, in one day. And he would say, you know, 9 o'clock in the morning, and then I wrote to you this morning. And so there was a tremendous communication going on. And they had postal people going up and down and all over the empire continually.
And this posta, post, a word of Latin origin?
That's...
It's all Greek. I can't do my program today. So tell me, Cicero wouldn't have carried anything around with him, would he?
Well, writing materials they carry, they have like a little box with stylus, stylus, you know, and stuff. They had these tablets of wax. So you'd write into the wax. Like a tabularium, tabule. And then, of course, when you're finished, you can wipe the wax flat and you start all over. And he talks about the ink being smeared because of the rain every once in a while. But they sent these tablets around the place.
But that's a Latin word. At least we've learned one.
Yeah, okay. Oh, yeah.
Tabula.
Okay.
Tabula rasa in Latin today we've got
yes.
on our program.
Yes.
Heartfelt thanks there, as always, to our popular Latin lover. He's Carmelite Father Reginald Foster, and he's currently working as the Pope's own Latinist at the Vatican's Secretariat of State. He'll be back again at this same time next week. And that brings us up to time. I do hope you enjoyed this broadcast. If you did, please let me know. Our email address is english@vatiradio.va. Or if you wish to drop me a line, the address is The English Programme, Vatican Radio, Vatican City. Thanks for listening. I'm Veronica Scaresbury. Be sure to check out our website. The address is www.vaticanradio.org/English. Bye for now, and don't forget that we'll be back again at the same time tomorrow.
You've been listening to the English program of Vatican Radio. Laudator Jesus Christus.